The reading is Nehemiah chapter 6, verses 1 to 19, and you can find it on page 489 in the church Bibles. When word came to Sanballat, Tobiah, and Geshem, the Arab, and the rest of our enemies, that I had rebuilt the wall and not a gap was left in it, though up to that time I had not set the doors in the gates, Sanballat and Geshem sent me this message. Come, let us meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono. But they were scheming to harm me. So I sent messengers to them with this reply. I am carrying on a great project and cannot go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you? Four times they sent me the same message, and each time I gave them the same answer. Then the fifth time, Sanballat sent his assistant to me with the same message, and in his hand was an unsealed letter in which was written, "It is reported among the nations, and Geshem says it is true, that you and the Jews are plotting to revolt, and therefore you are building the wall. Moreover, according to these reports, you are about to become their king and have even appointed prophets to make this proclamation about you in Jerusalem. There is a king in Judah. Now this report will get back to the king, so come, let us confer together." I sent him this reply. "Nothing like what you are saying is happening. You are just making it up out of your head." They were all trying to frighten us, thinking their hands will get too weak for the work and it will not be completed. But I prayed, "Now strengthen my hands." One day I went to the house of Shemaiah, son of Deliah, the son of Mehetabel, who was shut in at his home. He said, "Let us meet in the house of God inside the temple, and let us close the temple doors, because men are coming to kill you. By night they are coming to kill you." But I said, "Should a man like me run away, or should one like me go into the temple to save his life? I will not go." I realized that God had not sent him, but that he had prophesied against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. He had been hired to intimidate me so that I would commit a sin by doing this, and then they would give me a bad name to discredit me. Remember Tobiah and Sanballat, O my God, because of what they have done. Remember also the prophetess Noadiah and the rest of the prophets who have been trying to intimidate me. So the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul in 52 days. When all our enemies heard about this, all the surrounding nations were afraid and lost their self-confidence because they realized that this work had been done with the help of our God. Also in those days, the nobles of Judah were sending many letters to Tobiah, and replies from Tobiah kept coming to them. For many in Judah were under oath to him, since he was son-in-law to Shechaniah, son of Arar, and his son Jehohanan had married the daughter of Meshulam, son of Berechiah. Moreover, they kept reporting to me his good deeds, and then telling him what I said. And Tobiah sent letters to intimidate me.
When I was at sixth form college, I took physical education A level. I thought it would be easy, because I like sport. Not so. However, what I did enjoy was you pick two sports to play that you then learnt to teach and learn how it all worked. And one of the sports I picked was badminton. And I love badminton. Haven't played it for years, but do love it and used to love it. And it was one of the sports that I was actually quite good at, which is why I picked it, because I thought, oh, this will be all right. And I used to beat quite a lot of people that I played. And one man who I beat was a very tall, about 6 foot bloke, very wide-shouldered. And he used to get really irritated that I, tiny weeny me, would beat him. And so he employed the tactics of leaning as far as he could over the net with his racket, waving it about. And this was his way of trying to frighten me into making a mistake. And that's his tactic. That's what he did. If I managed to get the shuttlecock over into the said space, then he was in trouble. But his tactic was to stop me from doing that. And you know, I'm free to admit now, nearly 20 years later, that he did actually make me nervous. This 6 foot man put fear into every part of my being until all I could do was physically control my shaking. Couldn't serve, couldn't do everything. Ended up losing most of the time. I was frozen in place just because he was there. And I guess when I think about it, this really is not that surprising because after all, this was what he was trying to do. He was trying to get inside my head. He was trying to force me to do something I wouldn't normally do. He was trying to intimidate me. And he succeeded. Because this is what you do in sport, isn't it? A lot of the time. We see it all the time in sports that we watch, and I know you watch some sports. In tennis, on an important point, we see players rushing into the net to try and intimidate their opponent. We see swimmers drifting over to one side of the lane so that they're closer to those and they can put pressure on. We see sprinters going through a whole routine before they get down into the blocks, making sure they're the last one in position to try and make the others nervous. We see boxers standing nose to nose before a fight. Who's the hardest? We see hockey players rushing out at a short corner, trying to intimidate the striker as they go for goal. All of these are acts of intimidation to try and force someone else into making a mistake. And you know, it's not just in sports that people try these tactics either, is it? It's throughout life as well. Maybe it's not so obvious. People don't rush at you to try and frighten you. But it still happens. People still intimidate. And here in the 6th chapter of the book of Nehemiah, we find a classic case of intimidation. Through all those fancy names and all the different things that Pat read so well, we find just a simple case of intimidation. As we join the passage, of course, we are initially relieved because finally, after 52 days of solid work, 52 days of the people of God joining together, 52 days of hardship and pain, the walls of Jerusalem have finally been rebuilt. There's a small matter of the doors in the gates and all that, but in essence, the walls have been rebuilt. The work has been completed. Despite all things, a hostile enemy, a dodgy halfway point where we were going to give up, a case of internal wrangling, the people of Israel have eventually performed well. They've performed above their number and above their capability, and they've completed the task that God has called them to do. And at this point, I think we need to stop and pause, because the people of God have done something amazing. Normally, when we read the Bible, we pause to learn from the mistakes that the people of Israel have made. But here, in chapter 6 of Nehemiah, we pause to recognise a great achievement. A small group of believers who have worked tirelessly because God has asked them to, and they've achieved great things. This is a good moment in the Bible, if you ever want to look for one. An achievement has been made. And one reason that we know it's a great achievement is because at the beginning of chapter 6, as well as recognising the completion of the wall, we're once again joined by the enemies of Israel. Once again, we welcome back Sanballat and Tobiah, who, having realised that the Israelites have done something special, seek to perform a last roll of the dice to get rid of them, to destroy them. Only this time they focus their attention solely on Nehemiah, realizing the danger and the influence that he possesses. They decide that this time they're going to get rid of him. Now, we don't know whether they aim to get rid of him seriously, like, you know, kill him, do him in. But what we do know is that they want him out of the way. They want him gone. Whether it be back to Babylon to be a wine bearer, they don't care, or out into the wilderness to search around on his own, or into hiding somewhere in Jerusalem, they're not bothered. They just want Nehemiah gone. They want his influence and his authority to be out of the way, because they know with Nehemiah gone that the people of Israel will just settle back down and live in the Empire of Persia quietly, not making any fuss. The threat will be gone. And so they start this campaign of intimidation. Firstly, they call Nehemiah to a meeting. Come, let us meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono. Come, let's have a meeting, they say. Let's sort this out. Come on, Nehemiah. Let's just meet together. No problems. Now, this doesn't seem very intimidating, does it? A meeting. But bearing in mind their attitude towards Nehemiah, the fact that, you know, they've always sought to destroy what he's doing, the fact that the village they've asked to meet him in is in the middle of nowhere, they could have asked him to meet somewhere near Jerusalem, and the fact that actually they are known enemies of God's people, it means that this meeting takes place under an altogether different feeling. So Nehemiah declines. He's busy with the work of God. He's not got time for a meeting. And so they repeat the request three more times. And then when Nehemiah still doesn't come, they send a fifth request in an unsealed letter. Now, an unsealed letter was quite an odd thing at the time. Normally they were sealed, so no one could read them. And in effect, an unsealed letter meant that anyone was able to, and most people would have read the contents. There's no law against it. It was unsealed. You'd open it and you'd read it, which is not a problem, except for the fact that the letter that came to Nehemiah also contained with it some rumours. Rumours about Nehemiah and his actions. Rumours that he and the Jews were plotting a revolt. Rumours that he was about to become king. Rumours that he would get the prophets of Israel to proclaim this among the kingdom of Persia. Or if you like, rumours that Nehemiah wasn't just rebuilding a wall, but he was once again seeking to lead the people of God against the Persian Empire as enemies. The implication being that if the king were to hear about this, which he would, because it was an unsealed letter, then Nehemiah's life wouldn't be worth living. He'd be in grave danger. So there's a meeting, and there's an unsealed letter. And then following this, Sanballat and Tobiah turn up the heat even more by co-opting a prophet, Shemaniah. We don't know who this is, but it's obviously someone on their side. And their sole aim is to scare Nehemiah, to frighten him, by telling him that he's heard from some god, presumably, that people are coming to kill him. And not only are they coming at any chosen time, they're coming in the middle of the night when there'll be no one to protect him, no one around. And the only possible place, says Shemaniah, that Nehemiah could hide is in the temple of God. Not inside the walls or inside the gates, but inside the temple itself. Which in effect means that Nehemiah would have to break the law of God, have to go against Israel belief, have to go into the only place that priests were allowed to go and take refuge from those that were seeking to kill him. Now, looking at this process of intimidation today, we might think, well, it's not that bad, is it? I mean, there's a request for a meeting, you just say no. There's an unsealed letter, well, that's a bit more unfortunate, but it's rumour. There's a story to scare Nehemiah, but there's no proof anyone's going to kill him. How intimidating is that? It's not that bad. People do far worse today. But the thing is, Nehemiah is a cupbearer. He's a cupbearer for the king of Persia. a servant, if you like. Or in today's language, he's a normal person, like you or I. Sure, he's managed to do an amazing thing, galvanise the people of Israel to rebuild the walls of Jerusalem, but he's just an ordinary person. He's not a prophet or a king or a priest. He's not got training. He's not doesn't know how to combat people. And here he is facing the might of the Babylonian officials, facing the wrath of the king of Persia, facing the most powerful empire of its time. And he's facing it alone. No one's backing him up. No one's helping him out. When we think about it, it's a little bit intimidating, isn't it? And you know, back in the day, it would have been so easy for Nehemiah to run. It would have been so easy for him to hide. He nearly completed what God had asked him to do. It would have been so easy for him to then just disappear. Or if you like, it would have been so easy, faced with what he was faced with, for Nehemiah to turn his back on all that he was, turn his back on all that he'd been called to do, turn his back on all that he believed in, just to keep himself from harm. And who in their right mind would have blamed him for doing that? Do you know, when I was at secondary school, we had like groups of people, popularity groups, you know. We had the most popular, and then we had those that were kind of, we kind of called them geeks at school, and then we had, you know, the in-between group that didn't mean much. I was in the in-between group that didn't mean much. We just got along. And the top group was the Madonna group, who wore Madonna clothing. You know Madonna, yeah? Oh, it's good. Thought I wasn't connecting for a minute. You know, they wore the glove and, you know, they had the lace. Anyway, they wore this and they were cool. And everyone wanted to be in the Madonna group. Or everyone wanted to avoid the Madonna group because, you know, if they wanted to get at you, then you were in trouble. And I was in the middle group, so I wasn't really bothered. I thought I was quite cool because I'm like, the Madonna group, they don't scare me. Who cares about Madonna anyway? You know, I'm not scared of them. But one evening, one of the Madonna group decided that it would be funny to try and scare me. Now, since I'm not bothered about the Madonna group, it's not going to scare me, is it? So she came up with three of her mates, dressed in her Madonna garb, and she said, you, after school, outside, want you, going to do you in. Something like that. Can't remember the exact words, but you know. Basically, she's going to have a fight with me. And I was like, yeah, right, not scared. Ran off, frightened, absolutely terrified. As the school day went on, I could think of nothing else. I can't be beaten up by the Madonna group. None of my friends cared. They were like, okay, that's rubbish. When school finished, I decided I had three choices. I could tell a teacher, which I always said to everyone else, that's what you should do if you're in trouble. I could not take any notice and just walk out of school ready for Madonna and her gang. Or I could run and hide. I spent 45 minutes in the toilet, standing on the toilet seat in case someone looked under, because I'd seen films, they can see your feet, you know. 45 minutes! By the time I exited the school, there was no one around except the cleaner with a machine. I ran down the corridor, ran down the stairs, and got on the first bus that came along. It wasn't going where I wanted it to go, but I didn't care, because I wanted to be free from the clutches of Madonna and her gang. In effect, if you like, I was intimidated by the Madonna group. And because I was intimidated, I turned my back on all I believed you should do in that situation. I turned my back on who I was. I'm not scared. I turned my back on everything just so that I could be safe. And you know, as much as this is a childhood problem, it really isn't something that just happens in childhood, is it? I mean, maybe we don't spend 45 minutes hiding in the toilet very often. And maybe half the time we don't even realise it. Maybe it's not really something we talk about. But right up to present day, there are times when all of us feel intimidated. Sometimes it's not always by people. You know, we're intimidated by all manner of things. Computers can intimidate us. Technology in general is a fairly intimidating thing. Changing times. New laws that come in that we don't understand. Old laws that are ignored. Cooking intimidates some people. Me. Sports, exams, small spaces. We find them frightening, intimidating. But when it comes to people, it's even more scary. It's so easy to be intimidated by someone else. I mean, sometimes we find we're intimidated for the strangest reasons. It may simply be because someone has different skills to us, and we find this a little bit frightening. It may be because they appear very confident, and we're intimidated by that, or they say things in a certain way, and we feel like we're nothing. It may be because they challenge what we've always known and what we've always thought we wanted. And that intimidates us. Or perhaps we look at people and we think, oh, they're very holy. They know what they're talking about. And so we shrink back. There are all sorts of reasons why we feel intimidated. But whatever the reason, the fact is that however old we are, whatever our outward appearance, however confident we seem, we all get intimidated at times. And especially as part of the church in today's society, when actually we feel very small in comparison to the world around, where actually the statistics seem to indicate that we're in decline as a people of God, where the flow of culture time and time again seems to go against what we believe to be right. It's easy to feel intimidated as a church, in a time where people laugh at what we hold so special, in a time where people disregard us as foolish, unthinking, simple people, in a time when we're in the minority, when we always used to enjoy being in the majority, it's easy to feel intimidated as a church. And therefore it's easy for the church of God today to act intimidated. But you see, the important thing about Nehemiah is that when he was under threat of intimidation, when he faced Sanballat and Tobiah and all those lies, when this one man of God was feeling the heat from the might of Persia, the important thing about Nehemiah is that he stood firm. Even when he was summoned to threatening meetings or there were untrue rumours flying around or he was tempted to run and hide, he didn't. Instead, he stood firm. And not only did he stand firm, but he stood tall. He stood his ground. He refused to believe this intimidation. And he clung even tighter to the truth of God. But I prayed, he said. Now strengthen my hand in this situation. You see, Nehemiah knew that if the work of God was to be completed, if he was to do what God had asked him to do, if he was to put the doors in the gates and finish it all and complete his task, then above all else, he could not afford to change. He couldn't afford to change who he was. He couldn't afford to change who it was he believed in. He couldn't afford to change what it was God had called him to do. Because if he changed, he became nothing. If he changed, no one would bother to try and intimidate him because no one would even notice that he was there. And, you know, I think that's something that we can really learn from today. Because as the Church of God, when we feel intimidated, for whatever reason, it's easy to be tempted to change how we do things, to compromise on what we do, to try and hide who we are. You know, try and hide the fact that we're actually the people of God, that we're called to follow a living God, that he's called us to lead the way in society, that he's called us to be people who bring goodness and truth
and grace, not people who blend in and no one notices. Do you know, I heard a talk by Jonathan Sacks, the chief rabbi of the Orthodox Jews in this country. He came to Spurgeon's college, Baptist College, and he came to speak, and he was brilliant. But at the end, he had question time. And people, of course, were intrigued about the question of Jesus. What do you think about Jesus as a Jew? Who do you think Jesus was? And he was really good in his answers. He stood by what he believed, as you would expect, in front of all these Christians who were learning theology. And he stood and said, well, Jesus was a prophet. We don't believe he was the Son of God. And then someone said, well, what do you do as a leader in times like these, when people want you to be friends with Christians and Muslims? And what do you do in a society where people can't stand up for what they believe? Do you think we should blend in? Do you think we should try and, you know, find the truths in each religion and join together? What do you think we should do? And he said, you know what we should do? The most effective thing that we can do, each of us, whatever religion, whatever belief, is to hold tightly to what we believe, to cling on to what we believe and to live it out with all our might. He said that is the only way that people will respect us. That is the only way that people will want to talk to us. That is the only way that people will look at us and believe that what we have is something worth living for. He's not a Christian, but that's what he believes, to hold tightly, to cling tightly to what we believe. And in the face of intimidation, that's what Nehemiah did. And in the face of intimidation today, if we're to be the people of God and to live as God wants us to, then I believe that that's what we should do as well. To cling even tighter to what we believe and not let go.